out here. Man, would you listen to that? The visual particle counter is going crazy.
Well, I don't see anything out there.
Neither do I. Maybe we'd better take a closer look. Hold on, kid. Here we go.
Red alert, red alert. Asteroid at 3.9 AX Vector. Mass too large for spec scanner. Range 31,000 miles off port wing and closing. Prepare photon torpedoes. Red alert, red alert.
Welcome to episode 17 of the Coin Rejects podcast, a podcast where we talk about all aspects of the arcade game collecting hobby. I'm here with my fellow rejects.
I'm Jordan.
Brandon.
Ian.
And I'm Brian, and we are coming to you from the beautiful Pacific Northwest. If you would like to get in touch with us between our programs, you can visit our website at coinrejects.com. You can find us on Twitter at twitter.com/coinrejects, and you can also find us on Instagram, instagram.com/coinrejects, where we've had a little bit of activity.
Five
there.
Hits.
Yeah, we
nice
had some
hits.
Activity from the
best hits.
Portland Retro Gaming hits. Expo from Grinker's Grand Palace, and I think some photos from the infamous Barthcade.
Yeah, it's a good place. Come check us out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and don't forget our voicemail. It's 503-766-2263.
I almost forgot.
That's 503-766-2263. Leave
I
us a voicemail.
Forgot.
Anytime.
How do you remember it?
Yeah, I have a secret.
Okay. Yeah. He's old enough that he knows how to remember phone numbers.
Oh, I thought he was old enough where he starts forgetting them, too. So.
That, too. All right. What are we talking about today, guys?
So we played our game of the evening, and that game was Bally Midway's Lazarian.
But first, you got to mention that
before,
when we play games, it's a cold start, right? So we're not, that's why our scores suck, right?
No, it's just that we're not that good.
Yeah.
It depends on which score you're at talking about.
Well, I mean, in this case, I guess this time it's me because
nice.
Mine sucks.
All right, so I am the scorekeeper for the evening, as is usual, and coming in at number 4 is Brandon with 1,160 points.
Shit's rigged.
And with number 3, it's Brian with 1,480. I am number 2 with 2,660, and Jordan
wait
is,
for it. Wait
Jordan
for
wins
it.
With 9,550.
Yeah.
This is a game where you get 1 point per shot. That's why my score is so low.
And that was a cold start.
1,000 shots.
Just like Brandon. I saw all the screens.
Yeah. What? No, you
more
did good.
Than once.
You looped all the way around and got into the repetition. That's pretty good.
That's generally when I don't need to play a game anymore. Once I saw, if I see all the screens.
What
I'm
about,
like,
what about
it.
Pac-Man?
Yeah, I don't have to play that very much. No, you got to get all the fruits until you're up to the keys.
Okay.
Yeah.
Keys. Yeah.
So yeah, I totally thought that my score was going to be the lowest.
Jeez.
But Brandon came in right under the wire and saved me.
I guess the fact that I haven't been last every single time, I feel okay about it.
Yeah, gotta happen sometime. Yeah. So even though this is the Midway release of it, this is originally a Zakaria title. So this is under license to Midway from Zakaria.
Originally called Laser Battle.
Laser Battle.
Yeah, I don't know. Which do you like better? I mean, I kind of like Lazarian because it has my name in it.
Yeah, it says Laser Ian. I'm looking right at it. Yeah,
yeah. That's pretty
is that
cool.
You with a unibrow on the front?
No, fuck yeah, man. My unibrow is intense.
I definitely prefer Lazarian, I think. It's got a nice ring to it.
Laser
Battle. Laser Battle.
That sounds generic.
Does that sound too much like a laser game for you, Jordan?
I guess that's why I should like it. I don't know.
I think the game's okay. It's got got some unique features. It's got the four buttons like Space Zap where you shoot in four directions.
Yeah, but it has a joystick in addition to the four buttons. So it's sort of almost like a dual joystick kind of setup, except it's one joystick, four buttons. It's a unique control scheme for sure.
It's kind of like if you're playing Robotron on a console, like on a PlayStation controller.
Yeah, or like Super Nintendo. Or PlayStation or whatever.
Yeah.
Did they have Robotron for the SNES?
Yeah, they had the Midway Arcade Classic.
Did
or
they?
What is it? Yeah, yeah. They had Joust, Robotron,
Robotron.
Sinistar.
It's kind of an age-old conundrum of video games, like being able to move one direction and shoot another.
Yeah.
You know, you got to do something, and thus, or else it's just going to be like Berserk, where you can only shoot in the direction that you're moving. So, you know, and various manufacturers kind of tackled that. I like the Robotron solution, I guess you could say, with the two sticks. I think that's pretty good. And then, you know, you got like Flight Stick and Spinner, like Tron.
Right.
You
know?
Yeah.
And
Mad Planets.
Right. Mad Planets, yeah. Also,
or rotary joystick, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, where you click, 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 that kind of rotary, yeah, like SNK stuff, or Frontline, yeah, take it back further, the original. And then Food Fight, of course, with the analog, where you can kind of stay in one place but shoot all around you using, you know, a little light touch on the analog.
Yeah, that one's kind of like Berserk also, but I think the fact that it has that extra little bit of feature to it that makes it a little bit better than the Berserk action.
I agree.
Yeah, so this is a really hard game. It's kind of weird for the era it came out. You know, it's a fairly late game, late classic, I would say. But obviously, didn't do too well. Not a lot of people have it. But it's got some kind of throwbacks. Like, it has a fuel meter, which I think really had fallen out of style by 82. You see that on some of the earlier shooters, like Astro Blaster. You've got the fuel gauge. You have to deal with. In Lazarian, you can lose a man either by getting shot or by running out of fuel. Kind of an interesting tactic for a game that came out as late as this. I can't think of any others that had retained that. You know, it seemed like they had stripped it out by then.
I think it's because the games were so difficult. I mean, you're just adding another element. I mean, when you're playing this game, you don't even really care about the fuel gauge, and usually in games, the fuel gauges, you're like, you get frustrated, you get like stressed out, like, you know, it's just another thing besides getting shot you have to worry about. In this game, seems like the levels were so, you know, brief. Of course, they were very brief when I was playing, because I only got 1,000 points, but it was so brief. When you're going through the stages, you know, like, you don't even really care about it. I mean, you can almost, it doesn't, like I was asking Ian, does your fuel count down through the, you know, next level? And it doesn't, it resets,
right,
except for the last two stages, and then it carries over.
Fuel levels are always like just a cheap version of a timer, basically.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like, yeah, don't hang out and try to point press, because you're going to run out of time.
Yeah, I was saying, you can actually point press, and I was going to do that before I died. On the second stage, the tunnel stage, like at the very end, you know, before you have to dodge that guy on the third, the highest platform, whatever you could call
it. So the second one where the, like, weirdo green people are chasing after you?
Let's see.
Because the,
no, so it's the third one.
The third?
When you, there's like this little volcano thing shooting up.
Right. But you, the, but also the green people are chasing you.
Yeah. Before you cross those, if you just stay in front of that first little, I guess I'll just call it volcano. You could just sit there and keep on killing those guys before you go up to the last platform.
Okay.
And I did that when you guys were, you know, playing other games earlier. And I did that just until my fuel gauge was like pretty much almost out. And then I just, you know, docked with the ship. And then the final, you know, pussy stage, it reset. So it's like, that's like the only stage I think you can actually point press.
Yeah. I wonder actually, well, so there's that, and there's also on the very first stage we noticed that the bonus, I guess we should back up because people are not going to be familiar with this game and maybe actually describe how it works.
We're already into the second
stage. Yeah. So on the first stage, there is a red circle full of things that contain meteors, and when the containers turn yellow, you can shoot the meteor, which releases it. And then once you release all of them, then you can go inside of that red circle and then shoot the meteors.
Yeah, it's called shooting the yellow zone when they turn yellow. That's all it says.
I don't think I even realized that the meteors that started coming out were coming out from the things that you were shooting.
Yeah, they all come out of there. So there's only, you know, however many yellow zones there are, that's how many meteors there are. Which sort of begs the question, like, why didn't they get destroyed the first time?
Exactly.
And why are you releasing them when they're trying to kill you? I don't know. It doesn't, maybe not the best thought out game out there. And then the second part is navigate the tunnel of fear, which is a four part board. And on the bottom part, you just have to cross from the left to the right while these green guys come out and try and kill you. And also, you can only shoot right and left. You can't shoot up and down on this level for no good reason. And then the second part, there are four things that shoot at you and fly towards you, but are blocked by barriers. So you have to shoot the barriers that then releases them, and then shoot them and cross there.
And as you're doing all that, there's like a current gravity like against you, like each that's opposite of what direction you're going.
Yeah, there is something pushing you back the way that you came from, which is very annoying.
I figured it was just windy.
Could be. Yeah. Space winds.
Yeah.
So then on the third stage, it's kind of the same as the first, where you have to dodge. You have these little guys coming after you, but there are also the volcanoes that are shooting upwards at you. And then on the last stage, you have to dodge some asteroids or something. You can't shoot them. You only have to dodge, and then you have to dock with the ship. And then on the last stage, you see the monster itself. If you look at any of the artwork, it's got this tentacled robot monster thing. And you have to like get right up in its pussy and shoot it. And then its eye starts bouncing around. And then you have to shoot the eye 4 times, and then it repeats. So I think you can point press a little bit on the bottom of the second board and on the third section. Because those are both places where you can shoot the guys. And we also noticed on the first stage, there's a bonus countdown, sort of almost like a hurry up, where
right in the middle,
as soon as one of the zones turns yellow, it starts at 100 points and starts counting down. And then once it hits zero, it either loops back or maybe another zone ends up getting highlit. So you want to try and get that sooner rather than later. And you might want to pass it over and let another one come up so you can get all like 400, 600 points, whatever it is.
Yeah, the cool thing is, I don't know if it's cool or not, but once you do enter that little red zone, which they call it, and then you're destroying the meteors, it's like they're moving around you. I don't know, what is that, like the...
Orbiting?
And, yeah, like orbiting, or it's like you're like inside of a atmosphere or whatever, the red zone, whatever the fuck the red zone is. But they're moving like at a slow motion, you know, like frame rate, right? And then you're moving super fast
yeah, like, and you know, really twitchy, and it's really kind of weird, hard to control. Yeah, their like, bullets and them are slow, but you'd think that's easy, but it's not. And
it's
fucks with you. And then I think when you fire, the speed of shit changes as well to fuck with you more.
Yeah, well, I think the game just slows down because it's
crappy
that
hardware.
Good. Yeah.
Any other Zachariah games that other manufacturers licensed? I can't think of any.
Yeah, I can't either, but I don't think they had that many first-party titles to begin with. I think this is one of not too many.
According to...
I think Zachariah said, we'll give you this pile of shit, laser battle, if you can give us Tron, right? Because they also licensed Tron to Zakaria, right?
Well, they licensed a lot
of
different games.
They licensed a few. I've seen the Zachariah collection up in the Seattle show, and about half of them are familiar other titles, and about half of them are, original, it seemed. I like the one with the carrot, the rabbit,
or whatever. That one's cool.
Yeah, they have some really cool, like their cabinet for eyes is fucking awesome.
Yeah, all their cabinets have awesome art.
Seemed like a theme, though, with Valley Midway was like the whole staged, the four-stage deal, right?
Yeah,
Tron,
minigames,
Journey,
right? Yeah.
Gorf, and they're all within around the same time period, I think, except for Journey.
Get like four games for your quarter instead of one.
Yeah.
If you're good enough, which I was. I went through all of them. Did I mention that?
Yep.
Killed the boss.
I killed the pussy.
Four times you got to hit it.
Yeah.
The other thing about the fuel gauge on this one is that I don't think you really notice the fuel gauge until it actually starts running out.
Yeah,
it says fuel low and you blow up.
Yeah, it's like all of a sudden you're like, why is there a siren going? And it's like, oh, my fuel's almost out. Okay. And there's no way to get extra fuel on the levels, right? You just have to get through the level. Yeah.
I wonder, now that I'm thinking about it, I haven't actually paid attention, but I wonder if you get more fuel when you dock with your ship.
No, because it resets per stage.
Well, but does it reset on the stage after you dock with the ship?
Yes.
Well, there you go.
Every stage it resets, except for the last, the tunnel stage, right? So you're like...
Yeah, so the first two stages you dock, though, right?
Yeah.
So,
and that's why it doesn't replenish after you basically you release the eye or whatever. That those two last little stages there, it doesn't reset.
Is this game in MAME? Should be, huh?
Yeah, it's in MAME.
So I suppose you could play it with like a gamepad or something with four buttons and a directional control. It'd be real fucking hard.
Yeah, it seems real weird. Yeah.
But it seems like for the most part you use the one, whatever stage you're on, you end up just using one direction though. You know, like the last stage you're just using, you know,
up.
Yeah.
The last two stages and then...
Well, so one of the strategies I really like on the last stage, the very final stage is hard as balls because that eye...
Hard as
dodges like crazy, and like every time you shoot it'll go the other direction. It's really, really hard to hit. It's definitely one of the harder AIs of any game of this era that I can recall playing. And after you hit it the first time, it'll actually, before you hit it, it just bounces around and it doesn't try to collide with your ship. After you hit it once, it'll try and collide with you, but also that brings it down low enough that you can shoot it from the side, because you can shoot up and side to side. So that's actually a strategy that seems to be pretty good for that, is just hit it that once and then wait for it to come down onto the same plane as your ship and then try and hit it with a side shot.
Ah, and then if it tries its dodgy bullshit, it's just coming straight into your bullet.
Yep.
The closest thing that AI reminds me of is on Zelda 2, you know, the very end where you're fighting your shadow. And it just basically does whatever you do. So the more you try to go towards it, the more it goes away from you. And it's just annoying.
It kind of reminds me of Targ. I don't know if you've ever played.
I don't think I've ever played Targ.
So Spectar is the sequel to Targ, and the AI is a lot dumber in Spectar. In Targ, it's...
The sequel is dumber?
Well, the AI, it's got different gameplay elements, but they toned down the AI. The AI in Targ is intense. It's really, really hard to chase down the enemies. That reminds me a lot of how the AI behaves in Lazarian.
What game did you have at PRG? That was Spectar, right?
I had both Spectar and Lazarian there.
Oh, but I mean, out of the Exidy ones, Targ and Spectar.
I only had Spectar there.
Spectar, yeah. I played the crap out of that. I played that a lot. It's a fun game.
It is.
The cool thing about Lazarian is that it's, I guess you could kind of say it's rare. I mean, I've never seen the regular upright version, except for online. And that's the cool thing about, you know, having a diverse collection is like, it's... Generally viewed as like a piece of shit game because, you know,
it is.
Not only no one has it, you know, so no one's played it, but you could just kind of like look at that game and go, yeah, the game fucking sucks. But when you play it, you know, there's like some charm about it.
Definitely.
And it's funny because I always get bummed out when we pick games that are like, you know, viewed as like kind of crappy, right? But then like once you play games like these, it's like, it's actually, I don't know, it's like it's fresh, right? It's not like the Miss Pac-Man or Galaga. It's like, you know, this game fucking sucks, but it's different than all the rest that everyone loves, and it actually makes me want to play it more.
I don't think it sucks.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like
I think it sucks. it's too hard, and the music is annoying.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
We haven't talked about the music yet. Yeah, well,
I was going to say, it's like the most inappropriate music ever.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a space game, but it plays Flight of the Valkyrie and William Tell Overture.
Yeah, you tell that shit to Stanley Kubrick.
Laser battle, man.
That's true. Good point.
Now, was it in?
So it's like, you was think it in the original version too? The Lone Ranger or something going to be galloping across the screen while you're in this space battle.
It definitely sounds like an Atari 2600 game. Yeah,
I kind of get like a Western vibe, though. If I look at the marquee, it almost looks like a,
like, you know, a space cowboy
standoff.
I see like a sunset kind of in the font of the game.
If I blink, I just see, like, you know, brown.
The alien looks pretty cool on the marquee.
Yeah. The upright actually has really super art because it has a back panel above the monitor bezel, and the artwork is continuous on the back panel the bezel. Nice. It looks really sharp.
Kind of
really
shares
nice.
Like the same artwork setup, kind of like Blueprint. Blueprint's upright, right? How it's kind of has like the... It's the same cabinet, isn't it?
It is the same cabinet. Upright? Yeah. Same as the six pack.
The six pack. There you go.
Yeah.
Or the shit pack. Right? Most of those games suck. But let's talk about the art, though, like in the buttons. And it's kind of cool how the buttons are just not straight, you know, into the control panel. They have like the little yellow diamond.
Yeah, square bezels on them that are rotated. So they have like you were saying, in the D-pad style or SNES gamepad style configuration. But then the bezels are arranged such that it forms a square.
They're raised.
And they are raised bezels. It's, again, very unique. I don't think any other game used those specific parts. So I'm real glad mine has all of them. Real glad mine has all of them.
I swear I've seen, like, another game use that little square bezels, but I can't place it.
Yeah, can't place that.
And the story behind how you got this game is awesome. I mean, I know we've talked about it. I know we've talked about it before, but it's just so cool that you were able to find this rare game, Cabaret, for cheap and working.
Yep, stars aligned on that one.
That was so cool.
$150, and I cleaned it up and plugged it in, and it fired right up. So. Yep.
It's the best feeling.
It's really great.
Because why would you want to put an effort into a piece of shit game? I mean, right?
It's rare. It's a rare mini. Definitely belongs in my game room.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Agreed. So should
we... Yeah, you mentioned PRGE.
Yeah. I've mentioned playing Spectar at PRGE. What do we have, like... 150 games there or something like that?
161.
Not bad. I think we were all there at one point or another, or many points during the weekend.
Yeah, it was a little different this year because normally PRGE is only open on Saturday and Sunday, and the Free Play Arcade is just a portion of what's going on with all the vendors, the Tetris World Championship and speakers and everything. But this year it was open on Friday and only the Free Play Arcade was open, along with some of the arcade vendors and their console area, where just about all the consoles are set up for play. And so people got from 3 p.m. to around midnight. It was just people playing arcade games. And I was really surprised at how many people came out that first day. Is like, once the doors opened, it was just a flood of people, and it pretty much didn't stop the whole day, and there was people playing pretty much almost till midnight, I think.
Well, they were lining up, but at least, you know, there were people in line like an hour before it opened.
And in costume.
Yeah. It was a little better this year. I think they knocked out got rid of the cosplay contest.
No, the contest was still there.
It was?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, shit. Okay, yep. I don't know anything.
Oh, shit. You totally missed it.
I missed it, yeah. Yeah, I thought they got rid of that.
That's why I enjoyed rolling in the back door.
Yeah,
it was nice.
Yeah, coming in and playing games whenever we wanted.
So speaking of the PRG and all that shit, we actually did the panel again.
Right? Yep, that was... there were like three people lined up, and I was in line for a different panel,
and we were
right before ours, and someone was like, oh yeah, some shitty podcast is going
seriously
on. Dead serious. I was like, he's probably talking about that angry video game nerd.
Yeah.
That's gotta be that one.
Wasn't there like hundreds of people lined up for that guy? Video game nerd?
Yeah, it was crazy.
He had like three different...
Yeah, he had a couple different panels, and it was just... It was. I was surprised at how popular he was.
I don't get it. He drives me up the fucking wall.
It's a console-driven show anyways. I mean, that's where the crowds come from.
They come out for the YouTube celebrities.
That game is
bad. Yeah, there was definitely some good coin-op stuff happening this year. I was really glad to see more coin-op stuff represented there. So Steve Golson was there. Even though he was talking about console stuff, he can't just be a console guy.
No, and I hope that we could maybe get him back and maybe some more of the GCC guys, and maybe have like a GCC panel of them talking about their time at Atari and the games that they produced. I think that would be really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really cool because we were sandwiched between Steve Golson and Ed Freese.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a good spot.
Definitely.
And they're both what was really cool is you would expect, I don't know, usually when I meet someone of, you know,
famous
industry status, I guess. Yeah. they don't have time, you know, and it's like they wanted to talk to every single person that was interested, and it was really cool that like they would sit there and talk whatever question you had. They really enjoyed and were passionate about stuff they did.
Yeah,
and that was awesome to me.
Steve Golson was just really terrific. But so there's this term that some people use, which is computer famous, which is where you're not actually famous. You're just known by people who use computers. So they're like, they're video game famous, right? Like,
yeah,
if you told a random person in the street you met Steve Golson, they'd be like,
"Is that
what?
Your doctor or something?" Or like,
right,
mm-hmm. Dr. Golson.
Dr. Golson checked my
But yeah, I mean, for this industry, they're titans. You know, they're incredible, and so yeah, it's definitely nice being able to meet someone that, you know, had that much impact on the industry and, like, frankly, on our lives, and have them end up just being so into it and so nice.
Yeah, he was probably my highlight, seeing that panel and talking to him afterwards and stuff. And you can tell he is just really, he's still into it. He's still passionate about it. And the stuff they did out in Cambridge was pretty amazing. And I was like, even though he's talking about the Atari 7800.
The Pro System.
That's right. That's right. Okay,
yeah, which sounded awesome. And I didn't even know the story that Atari could have like taken over pretty much the console
Nintendo's
world from NES, probably, if they would have actually released this thing when they had it. I wanted to go play one of those.
Yeah. They wouldn't be a part of the Blade Runner curse if they would have released the 7800.
Yeah, I had no idea about that story. It was really cool. They had really developed a great system.
Yeah, so after the panel, he totally was like, oh, you wanted to talk about Food Fight or whatever? And I had my game up there. Mine and Brandon's Major Havoc were in the museum section. You couldn't touch our games. So he was like, oh, yeah, let's... Do you know about the Easter egg in the high score table? And I was like, no, what's the Easter egg? So he's like, oh, come on, I'll play a game and show you. So we go there and fire the game up, and I'm playing with Steve, and he's telling me all kinds of stories about the development, and he shows me the Easter egg, whereas if you get on the high score table, If you hit 7 backspaces and put in the initials JAH, was the initials of the game developer,
Jonathan Hurd.
Yep. And it shows his like monogram, which is a J that's kind of below the baseline, and then the line for the J
small
goes,
caps J's.
Yeah, well, it's, yeah.
It's like kind of cursive too, right?
And it goes down and it makes the line for the A and the H, and it's a...
It's an Easter egg.
Yeah, it's an Easter egg. It's a pretty cool little... Pretty cool little thing to happen upon.
Does that stay on the high score table then for everybody to see?
I think if you get it in the top three, because the top three scores are the ones that stay.
Okay.
But yeah, if it stays on the bottom section until the game gets power cycled. Yeah.
Got that EA ROM going.
Yeah.
So if your name is, if you have those initials, then
there you go.
I just use it anyhow. It's the coolest.
Well, you got to do the 7 backspaces first though, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And after his presentation, he had just pulled some stuff out of his bag, and he had a prototype 5200 to 7800 adapter that they were developing that was going to try to save the Atari 5200, where it could not only play 7800 games, but it could also play 2600 games, which is something the 5200 couldn't do. And he also had some GCC recruitment manuals, not manuals, but brochures.
Those were cool.
And it showed, like, one of them had like Miss Pac-Man on the front, and there was a picture of a Quantum in a Tempest cabinet that had like prototype on the top.
Yeah, the marquee was way different.
Yeah,
it was cool.
That was it. Yeah.
And so yeah, it's just all these really cool things that you would never see anywhere else. And he's just like, oh, I've got this and I've got this. And we're all sitting there going, oh my God, and taking pictures of all of them. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah, they made a shitload of stuff for Atari and without really being known. And I think he said they had, like, at one point, 150 employees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
something like that.
A really big shadow arm of Atari in the, late early 80s, I guess you would say.
Yeah, I didn't even realize about GCC until I heard the Miss Pac-Man story, and then it wasn't even later than that that I found out, oh, Food Fight is developed, and then I found out, oh, Quantum, and it was all these really cool games, really inventive and unique games that were produced and were done by them, so he made super cool company.
He made sure and told me he had the crazy auto ROMs in the code, and it was fine. It was not going anywhere. It was not going to disappear, and he would release it just as soon as Namco releases all the Pac-Man stuff to the general domain.
So never public domain?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, fuck. That's blackmailing.
I know, those are some ROMs that people would like to get a hold of, but we did not kidnap him and try to get him from
us. Yeah, I'm sure he carries them.
Ed Freeze was really cool, too. He told the story about the color gotcha that he bought off of eBay and got working, and also his computer space that he also repaired. But the crux of his presentation was kind of similar to our presentation, was that we need to preserve these games. He had like a picture of games deteriorating. He's like,
nice.
We have to save, you know, we have to save these games, fix them, and preserve them for, you know, future generations. So yeah, it was like the perfect...
That was cool.
He was perfect bookends to our...
Yeah,
to
sat in our panel too. It was cool.
Yeah.
He was like, how can you just like ignore the beginning of this whole, you know, this whole... entertainment mega complex or whatever, you know, this is the beginning of it all. And, you know, now it's video games make more money than motion pictures. I mean, and how can you just let this stuff just rot away and be lost to history? Not history? I don't know. Be lost.
It is.
Yeah. So good panels, definitely.
Yeah. And they're both really, really cool. I mean, it was funny because right after the panel, he wanted to show you that Food Fight Easter egg, but then he was excited to talk to
Ed
Freeze, and we're like, oh man, he's gonna ditch out, you know, because like he was like really wanted to talk to him, and so we went over to Food Fight and like, yeah, he's not coming.
We're just hanging out,
and it was cool that he, you know, I'm sure his schedule is pretty busy, and he actually took the time and not only like showed the Easter egg like a couple times because then we showed up, but then he went through slides of, you know, like the Food Fight.
He actually had a presentation.
Artwork and game design notes.
I guess Jonathan had done a Food Fight presentation with his computer. So he was like, oh, I've got this slide deck on here. And he had this slide deck full of handwritten notes from the development of Food Fight, like the original proposal to like bitmap drawings of the pies and the characters and stuff like that. So that was really cool.
Yeah. I always wonder, like, they're so passionate about the stuff they used to make. I'm wondering, like, how passionate are they to release the stuff that they always wanted to include in the game, but were, like, cut, you know, like the like in Food Fight, there was there's supposed to be a crowd,
right,
in the stands, mm-hmm. and there was a stage where there was pies on tables that you'd go and grab instead of just having the food spread around the stage. Mm. I mean, do you think if you bugged them about it a bunch and you had all the resources available, you know, would they be passionate about redoing that stuff? I know.
No.
I think all the development hardware is gone. I asked him about it.
You don't need,
like,
you can,
all that stuff.
You don't need all that
You don't
shit
need
anymore.
That anymore. You just need a computer. Okay.
But it's also, that stuff was kind of nixed in the development of the game. So it wasn't necessarily something that they wanted to put in and they couldn't. It was kind of like, well, we have this idea. Is this going to work? And the reason why I didn't go in there is because it didn't work.
But just the extras, right? Like it's like a director's cut of shit. You know, it's like the people in the background.
Well,
it's not,
but see,
it's just
the director's cut is like they filmed it and they decided not to include it. But a lot of this stuff is
like storyboarded.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's like they storyboarded it and they're like, oh, the hardware can't do that, right? So
sure can, man.
So it's
it can now.
It can now. But then you're talking about like, oh, what is it? It's a fucking fantasy MAME, whatever, right? It's not the real hardware. It's not like you're just putting something back in that had to get taken out. It's like you have to build something that never got built.
Make a cardboard backdrop of people in the stands. Put it on a
half silver mirror.
Floating on top. That would be kind of cool. Yeah. I'd be down for that.
You're just rotting fruit.
Real fruit, like in the background.
So this is the first year that I actually brought a game to be played in the arcade, and that was my Dragon's Lair. So insert laser talk drop here. But it was really cool. I'd never taken a game there before, and it was just cool to see people playing the game.
Laser games.
And really liking it, and I would come up and play with some. There was one guy the first day that he was playing it, and he was really into it, and I was playing it with him. We'd do like two-player games, and we were talking about it and everything. And
yeah, you got that right. There was one guy.
No, but there's like 6,000 people watching the spectator monitor.
Exactly. Come on, the spectator monitor was a big hit.
Yeah.
So yeah, that I just thought that was really cool to talk to other people about it and, you know, hear about their memories of it. And then on the second day, I put the Space Ace disc in there, so then nobody could play it.
Yeah. I wonder, like, what people's reactions were, because that was, like, the only laser game there. Like, is this just some fucking cartoon playing on the screen? I mean, you know, I was playing, the only two games I played there the whole show were a couple pinball games. I played Bad Cats and...
I like that game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do too. And, what was it? I don't know. It's another pinball. But right next to me, there's an older gentleman, and he was trying to coin up a pinball game, and he couldn't figure it out. And I'm like, you know, it's just right there. And his wife thanked me and all that stuff. And, you know, because it was for some reason, it was one of the games that didn't have like a flashing start button. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering, you know, similarly, are people wondering, what the hell is this like cartoon playing?
I think there's definitely the people that didn't get it that would try to play the first stage and then kind of throw their hands up and leave. But
that's why it made so much money.
Exactly. <Yeah. laughs> But no, that was a lot of fun. I enjoyed playing that with people and seeing their reactions to it.
Yeah. You know, I've brought games there, I think, 4 years, something like that. Maybe five. Definitely four. And I always find it really gratifying to see other people enjoying the games that I've, you know, put so much time into making work mm-hmm. and sometimes making look nice. sometimes. Depends on the game. So that's always really cool. And it was really nice to see, I brought Tank 2, which is one of the older games that I own, and it just got a shitload of play. You know, I saw a couple of like 8-year-old kids playing it, and the game's 3 times as old as they are, and they're just having a blast playing it. That's really awesome. I think that's very special.
Maybe 5 times as old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
3 times as big.
Yeah. That's the only thing I didn't like about having Havoc in the museum area. It was like a double-edged sword of, I really want people to play it, but I don't
really
want people
want
to
people
fucking
to
touch
it.
Right.
And so next year, I think I talked to Rick, emailed him about, he said he really wanted to turn it on and have people play it. And I was like, I didn't have it on because it was having some monitor issues. And he said, next year we should have it on and have people play it. So, you
know. Stick it in the arcade, man.
Yeah.
It's like I had this feeling that my game would go in there and just get beat to hell. And it was like, that didn't happen at all. It was, you know,
only time they get beat to hell is moving them.
Definitely.
Exactly.
That's true. Yeah. There's more wear and tear.
Yeah. The main issue I have is that someone will beat my high scores. And that's always annoying.
Beat your high scores to hell.
Yeah. I haven't actually looked to see how bad the damage is on Centipede. I'm sure it's not good.
Dead scores.
Yeah. You know, I put some fresh side art on my Asteroids Deluxe and then took it to the show, and it came back with a nice chunk out of it.
Really?
Yeah. So, oh well.
Live and learn.
Can't see the side art anyways.
Yep. I carved my name in the side.
You carved a
that's
quantum,
my name.
Quantum,
you carved
quantum,
your high score in
quantum
the side.
Dick in the side
yeah,
of.
I couldn't draw a picture, so I had to get the pocket knife out.
Yeah, it was good. You know, I like taking games there. I think I took 10 or 11, something like that. And, you know, being someone who wants to keep games running, it's always nice when you can take your games out and they stay up for the whole weekend. So. I've had a good track record on that, and definitely feel better about it. They probably get, you know, left on more over that weekend than any ever. Other time of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was like a year's worth of wear. Right?
Oh, yeah.
And that's kind of like the theme around our panel, too, is like getting people to play the games and getting into collecting. And, you know, I'm sure 95% of the people that were playing those games never play arcade games.
Or haven't played them in years.
Yeah, because they're there for the console stuff. And that, you know, just them being there and on, and it's like, oh, okay, let's go play this. And there's like a crowd. And, you know, the theme around our panel was, you know, find a game, work on it. There's really cool aspects of the hobby besides just playing the game. And, I mean, I don't know if we got that point across because, you know, there wasn't very many people there because we're opposite of
because we're
AVGN, but... additionally, I don't know, maybe we could fine tune. I mean, like, what do you guys think worked and didn't work?
The panel format, I don't think is the greatest for us. It seems kind of contrived and not too exciting because we don't have a lot of back and forth speaking and
no beer. Damn, are we doing a postmortem on this panel live? Jesus Christ.
No, it's fine. Yeah. I don't know. It's fine. I thought we talked about ourselves too much, but
that's what I was going to say. Yeah.
I really like, so I did a panel the next day just about repairing games. And man, I really wish I had more time to prepare for that because I thought I had enough slides and I really didn't. So we kind of filled the last half of it with Q&A. You know, people people came here and said, you know, I have such and such problem. What do you think I should do, or how should I try and address it? And that was really good. And the level of audience participation and engagement was really terrific.
How many of them were actually arcade owners, do you think?
Well, so I knew a bunch of people.
Arcade machine owners.
I mean, there were enough people that were saying, I have a machine that's doing X.
Right. You know,
I think a lot of people had them. Yes. And
there's addiction in call centers for that.
Yeah. But, you know, that's one thing I always want to get out there is that anyone can fix these things if you just lean in enough.
Yeah.
And, like, get over the fear of, like, you know, you can touch a monitor and it won't kill you. Which is, you know, it's intense if you've never done it before. It's a major deal. And then you do it, you know, 400 times and you don't give a shit. Yeah. You're like, oh my God, I'm fibrillating again, whatever.
Yeah, the most it will do is catch on fire and smoke. I mean, in your basement. Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, I thought your panel was really good. I learned a few things by watching it, so.
Did you, were in attendance?
I was in attendance.
I missed it. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I was sitting there right between his two daughters who both asked a question.
they asked so many questions.
Was that staged?
No.
I don't think so.
No.
You put some ringers out there?
Bad ROM means
No, there was, what does RAM mean?
Yeah.
What does ROM mean?
What is CPU?
So I actually really like those questions because, you know, there's
great.
My perspective is that, like, I assume that everyone understands what those things mean, but lots of people don't. Yeah. So it's good to have. I actually really appreciated the really basic questions because I want to make sure everyone understands the basics before they get into, like, oh, this is how a clock circuit works or whatever.
Yeah. Seems like a lot of the popular panels were more like, you know, there's history of games. There was, you know, Ed's was, you know, restoring this stuff. And it wasn't like a, you know, a whole start to finish, like, here, this is my name, this is what I did. It was just get straight to the topic. And I think, you know, if we do that next time, I think we'll be a little bit more passionate about it. I mean, I don't want to talk about myself. I just want to talk about games, you know?
Yeah, the most popular panels are always going to be the more entertainment-focused panels where you have somebody that you've seen on a video that you watch as a YouTube television show or whatever you want to call it. But those are always going to be the more attended ones. You know, it's harder to get people out to see the Atari box art artists and stuff like that. But there are dedicated people out there that want to see that stuff. And so it's always good to...
I think if you know, there's more than one person in the room, it's worth it to me
totally.
Because it's just like this podcast. I mean, I'm
talking to you, one person out
yeah,
there.
Yeah. It's like, I just like talking about it. I like talking to you guys, talking with you guys about it, you know?
Speaking well, of talking to people out there.
No, yeah. All right. Good segue.
Is it time to do a little listener feedback? I know we ask people.
Do we have any? Has anyone called the voicemail
what
number
is the voicemail
and left
number?
Us a voicemail?
And
do we have a voicemail number?
Yeah. And speaking of that, it's been about a year, a little over a year since we've started.
Woohoo!
And we've never addressed...
Happy anniversary to us.
Voicemails, because
we haven't really been
hoarding them to make
talk too much.
Look like a substantial
year's
amount.
A year's worth of voicemails in one show.
And we're playing three.
So our first voicemail is from Robert, and it goes a little something like this.
And here we are.
Hey, how you doing? This is Robert here in Virginia. And I was just listening to the podcast and wondering, what's the voicemail number for the podcast? Thanks. Bye.
That is an excellent question.
That is
a real riddle.
I mean,
he's
very sincere. So
I think Jordan can answer this question.
He's definitely not yanking our dicks.
Robert, thanks for calling us. And if you want to know, the voicemail is 503-766-2263.
I'm sorry, 2623?
That's 503-766-2263. 24 hours a day. Operators are standing by.
We also offer TV VCR repair.
Can we get? Do we have a vanity number like 1-900 coin Reg?
1-900 Courtney Jacks.
Yes. Reggies.
All right. So should we move on to our next voicemail?
Yeah, that was short and sweet. I hope the other ones are also similarly
that was
short
easy.
And sweet.
That was easy to answer. So we'll take those any day. So I believe the next one is from my buddy Dave from Buffalo, who I got to meet at Grinker's. The best arcade show I've ever been to. If you can go there, go there. That guy is amazing.
So is it a show or is it just an arcade?
A show.
It's an arcade, but it's Grinkfest, which I believe... It's an event. It coincides with Steve Grinker's birthday, I believe, because his birthday was Wednesday of that week. So I'm thinking that that's what Grinkfest is all about. So he has an amazing arcade with he had 200 classic games. I mean, he's got like all the Sega Vectors. He's got, you know, Environmental Disatron. He's got two dozen like sweet black and white games. He's got so much out there. And I mean, really, you need like 3-4 days to play them all. And there is a tournament that coincides with that for prizes and stuff. And I will not miss that again. That was a great show.
Event.
Anyhow, here's Dave from Buffalo.
Hey, Coin Rejects. This is Dave from Buffalo. I've been listening to your show for a while. Enjoyed a lot. I've got about 9 games. New collector last couple years. Haven't really done any technical work. I just keep seeming to be buying parts. And I haven't done really anything except put a trackball in my Centipede. But my question today is, since I don't know anything technical, I had a question about monitors. What is the difference when you're discussing monitors? What is degaussing, the rejuve, and the convergence? When you're talking about those issues, I'm a little... I believe the convergence, you're adjusting something on the neck of the tube, I believe. But I was just wondering if you could answer that for me. And also with my Centipede here, when you move the Archer over to the left of the screen, it just has a little purple haze. I was wondering what that would be. I mean, it looks pretty good. The monitor looks good. It's G07, but just wondering if you had any idea what that would be. Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate it, and I will talk to you later. Thanks a lot.
Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix is the purple haze.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jimi Hendrix.
I think I can field the first one of these. Anyone else? Actually, I'll field rejuving.
I think I know the purple haze.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
Is it in your eyes?
Yeah. Lately, things don't feel the same.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you should go ahead and answer that because that'll dovetail nicely with some of the other questions.
Okay, so I'm thinking the purple haze, what that is a little convergence problem out on the edge.
Isn't do we have a buzzer stock sound?
He's saying the Archer gets purple around it when he moves to the edge.
He didn't say around it. All right, so...
he said around the Archer, so I'm thinking that, you know, it's not converged right on the edges.
It's the left of the screen. It has a little purple haze.
But
you're assuming that haze means like a border, which is an incorrect assumption, or at least a fallacious assumption.
Jesus.
Wow.
Just saying, like, All right. If like the archer is green, right? And if you have a purity issue where you're getting red and you're green as it hits the side, then it'll be purple. So anyway,
always going to be purple.
Right. Okay. So
green shouldn't have any red in it, right? Basically, because it's green.
So
it's not white. The archer's not white. The archer's green. You're right. The archer's green with maybe a red dot or something.
Well, the eyes, right? It changes color based on the stage.
Okay.
But all right. So what's happening is you have poor purity. So your monitor has three guns, red, green, and blue, and they are aligned. Well, all right. So in the neck, in the electron guns, there are three, and they are aligned such that they hit only red, green, or blue phosphors on the shadow mask of your monitor. And, well, they go through the shadow mask and hit the face, where they have phosphors that emit red, green, or blue when the electrons strike them.
And these red, green, or blue, they're on top of each other?
No, they are in a configuration where they are next to each other, but when you view them, the distance is such that the colors combine.
Okay.
And they appear to form different
They're close
colors.
Enough to form right. one color.
If you set any CRT display to a white screen and you look at it with a magnifying glass, you'll see the individual
red, green, blue.
Yeah, okay. The individual phosphors. So purity means that when you have a screen full of red, you only are lighting the red phosphors. A screen full of blue, you only light the blue phosphors. A screen full of green, you only light the green phosphors. If you have a purity error, it means that for any of those situations, you are lighting phosphors other than what you should. And this dovetails nicely with the answer about degaussing, because the beam is deflected with electromagnetism. And if there is any residual magnetism on any part of the monitor, then that will cause an error in the deflection such that it will hit adjacent phosphors, which are the wrong color. So you should start by getting a degaussing coil, degaussing the monitor. And that'll probably correct it. Or you can try moving the game to a different position, because the Earth's magnetic field can cause some issues there.
Yeah, and don't ever degauss and then move your game. Make sure it's in its final place. I mean, obviously, you can, you know, it's not like you're screwed for life.
You can bump it. You can move it an inch or two.
Yeah, but if you have it, you know, in the corner of your room over there, it's facing, you know, and you want to move it to the other corner of the room, you know, obviously wait till you're in the final destination, then degauss, because that, you know, the Earth's magnetization is going to basically fuck it up.
It's going to equalize the monitor such that whatever the magnetic fields are that it is subjected to from the Earth are neutral relative to the deflection. So anytime you move it, you may need to degauss it. And that includes keeping it in the same position, but rotating it so it faces a different cardinal direction. If degaussing doesn't fix it, then it is a purity error that needs to be corrected. There's a set of magnets on the neck of the tube, the ring assembly, and the two front magnets control your purity. So you're going to want a test pattern generator of some sort in order to correct this, and look in the manual, the procedures in there. It's a little involved, but basically, like, there are two magnets and you rotate them either together or spread them further apart or closer together, and you can get your purity nailed that way.
Yeah, and lesser issues that could happen as well that could cause that would be like unshielded speakers if you install those, or if there's some other, like, if, you know, your kid was being funny and put a magnet on your screen, I mean, that could cause it as well.
I would say monitors do have a built-in degaussing coil that's meant to, like, take care of this in most cases.
Yeah, they don't do shit.
Yeah, they never do anything.
Throw that shit out.
Something.
Unless you have, like,
it doesn't work.
Well, don't throw it out. Leave it on
the monitor.
If it's
like a computer monitor, like a, you know, like those NEC, like those multi-syncs, go.
Yeah, those are pretty heavy.
That's a different story, but arcade monitors, it's like non-existent. You might as well, you know, disconnect that.
It does something. It goes
it doesn't do enough to actually make a difference. You need to go and get a degaussing coil in order to do this. And you can look up how to use it, but the short version is there's a button on it that actuates it, and you want to put it as close to the face of the display as possible and move it in a circle that gets larger as you move further away from the monitor. And once you are far enough away from the monitor that it... So when you put it right up against the screen, the monitor is going to go crazy. You know, it's going to change shape and distort.
Pool of water, basically.
Look all fucked up.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure people have put magnets by CRTs and kind of know what is up with it. So that's what's going to happen. And then you want to move it in an ever-enlarging circle as you move away while keeping the deflection ring is what I use. parallel to the face of the tube.
Yeah, it's better to stand like sideways to the game, or was it perpendicular or whatever.
Yeah, and then once you're far enough away that there is no effect whatsoever on the monitor, then release the button.
Yeah, it's almost like you're pulling that out of the viewing space, you know, and sometimes you have to do it more than once.
Yeah.
Or sometimes you may be hosed and you actually have to, you know, move the game around because that Earth's, you know.
Now, what about when you have to...
You're not going to get that out.
What about when you have to move the yoke in and out? Is that affecting purity?
Yes.
The whole physical yoke, you know, with the wedges and stuff, getting that set up, right?
Yeah. If you... I can't stress enough how much people should go and read the manual because it covers this whole procedure in detail and... It's kind of hard to read, but if you read it and then just try it, then it becomes a lot more obvious.
Yeah, just take it one step at a time. And usually it's you got to make sure the yoke is in the right place, and then you do the purity, and then you do the convergence.
Right. But also they say you should start out by letting it warm up and then degaussing it. So maybe you got to degauss it before you do any of that stuff.
Yeah, like what is it, 30 minutes?
It's going to be in the manual, but it's at least 10. Depends on the monitor.
35.
So do you want to cover rejuvenation also?
I will also cover rejuvenation.
I think you should probably just do like a high level of it.
So rejuvenation is not like a regular adjustment that you should need to do, basically. It's kind of a whole nother ball of wax, I would say.
Right. So there in the neck of the tube is the electron gun assembly. And there is a specific substance on the guns, which is depleted as the monitor is operated. And the less of that substance there is, the dimmer the display is gets because the electrons are emitted from it. And rejuvenation is, you need a tool called a rejuvenator, and you hook it up to your tube. And what it does is it sends a bunch of current through the guns in the hopes that if there's an impurity in that substance, then it will bake it off. And therefore, you will get more emission and a brighter tube. So if you have a tube that's looking really dim, then this can sometimes bring your emission up to a level where you can get a nice bright image. It's sort of a measure of last resort.
Yeah, it's like a last-ditch effort. Yeah.
Definitely. You know, you would do it if the monitor is so dim that it's unacceptable and you don't care if it works or not. But really, you should be looking at swapping the tube out if you're in this situation, if at all possible. The main thing that a rejuvenator is good for is not the actual rejuvenation, but it's testing. Because with a rejuvenator, you can test a tube and see exactly what its emission is and make sure the filament is working right. The filament is what gives you the neck glow. Without that glow, you get no electron emission. And you can also clear up some shorts and other issues. But the actual rejuvenation process is definitely last resort. And if you have the option to replace the monitor or replace the tube, you should be doing that instead.
Yeah. Going back to like a multiple episodes back where we talked about game preservation and what stuff's going to be available and hoard monitors. I mean, I'm sure back when rejuvenators were like, and CRTs were in their prime, you know, it was like, it was more of a testing tool, not, you know, the rejuvenation tool. Now it's like, you know, you should really take advantage of like the technology of it and really just analyze, like Ian said, don't go for the, what is like the final, like the max you could do. It's called a...
So it depends on the model. You're saying on some BK models, they have the clean and balance setting
and then there's like,
versus rejuvenate.
Yeah, exactly.
So they're, and that just controls the amount of current that it sends through the actual gun.
I would say also have a good working knowledge of how to adjust your monitor before you go rejuvenating.
Like
you know?
Clean the front of.
Yeah, make sure it's not dusty, but know how to adjust the neck board pots, the, you know, the drive and the cutoff, because that's usually all you have to do is just balance those out a lot of times if you have a bad color, you know.
Well, if you have a rejuvenator, it'll show you right away what your emission is and whether it's too high or not. So you can see, like, you always should start out by checking the emission of the guns to see are they actually emitting enough or not. The one thing that I found rejuvenators are really excellent at is black and white tubes. If you have a dim black and white tube, you just zap that shit. You know, it's you're almost always going to end up with a much better picture. With color tubes, it's definitely more hit and miss.
Yeah,
and
there's more stuff to go wrong. I mean,
there is. Well, three times as much.
Yeah.
And if you, a lot of times what you'll do is you'll say, oh, you know, they're all kind of low. I'm going to hit the red gun. Okay. And you have to rejuvenate every gun individually. So in a color tube, you have three, one for each color. And in a black and white, you only have the one. So on the color, you'll hit red, you'll hit green, you'll hit blue. And a lot of times hitting like the second and third guns will negatively impact the first one. Mm. So it's kind of a balancing act. Do I do this again? You know, it's a real hassle. And, you know, if you have a tube that's just irreplaceable, then, you know, go for it. But if it's just a regular tube that you can pull out of a TV, yeah, I just check the emission. Oh, it sucks. Okay, swap it. That's
like,
it.
Like a K7000 compatible.
Yeah,
can you,
yeah.
Can just you over rejuvenate a tube?
So it's going to depend on the specific model of rejuvenator and like whether it's broken. You absolutely can.
Let's just keep on hitting the button all day. Let's see if it...
You absolutely can ruin a tube that's marginally working by hand. Like, I think you have a bigger risk
of
like necking.
You can do that anyways. If it's even if it's like a good condition monitor, right? There's a margin where you could end up ruining the tube. Like, say it's like a fresh monitor, and you decide to just fuck with the shit. Can you end up ruining the tube if you just go crazy? I mean. Is that why? That's why it's a last resort, right? You shouldn't technically go through the final stages unless A, you have a backup, or you don't care.
I rejuvenated a shitty looking tube for someone before on like a Paperboy championship sprint. You know those medium res.
Yeah.
That they a lot of times they look like shit, and his was really washed out, really bad. I'm like, okay, let's hit it with the rejuvenator. It looked great. Like it was. I think he had championship sprint running in it, and the track was like a nice black and gray again. And like 2 months later, it was back to shit.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's when it's gone, right?
I mean,
yep.
I would think so, unless you want to do that every month. I don't know how long that's going to last.
That's like, you know, polishing a turd.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, basically.
Yeah, well, that's hosed. Do it right before you sell the game.
Fucking bright, crisp monitor.
Yeah. Look at the picture. It's amazing.
30-day guarantee.
All right, and then the last one was Convergence, I think. But I feel like I've been talking a lot, so someone else can
read the manual again. You know, it's in there. It's the same tabs on the back of
it's
the.
It's not
neck.
The same.
Well, they're tabs on the back of the neck. Well, no, you and then you got the little stick-on things and all that. So go ahead, Ian. You tell us.
Oh God. Okay. So
you have to move the yoke back and forth, right?
No.
Isn't that part
you,
of it?
So in order to get your convergence right, you have to have your purity right. And in order to get your purity right, you have to pull the yoke backwards on the neck. And then you see a band of colors. You see green in the center and red and blue on the sides.
I consider that the purity adjustment.
Right. You have to get the purity.
You
got to
do that first.
You have to do it first.
Okay. I thought we were past purity.
No, we're
but
still
there. But if your monitor's good and you just have like a few, you know, sections of the monitors that are out of whack, you don't fuck with the purity. I mean, you're just doing the convergence strips and maybe messing with some of the, you know, the tabs. You're not messing with the purity.
Yeah. So the tabs are the other two spinny dilly doos.
Okay. So you're on the there are two kinds of convergence. There is static convergence and dynamic convergence. Static is the convergence at the center of the tube. So if you think about the configuration of the electron guns in the neck of the tube versus the display, if you don't deflect the beam at all, which is what static means, it's not being deflected, it just shoots out right into the center of the display. So that's what static means, is the convergence at the center of the display. And the ring assembly controls static convergence. So not the purity rings, but the other two sets behind that are the static convergence. Dynamic convergence is the convergence at the edges of the display where the beam is being deflected. So moving, it's dynamic. And for the dynamic convergence, you have to, first of all, get the yoke into the correct position, which in order to get it, you have to worry about both the position relative to the face of the tube, which is also the purity adjustment. And then once the purity is good, then you have to consider it tilting from side to side and up to down. And in order to do that, you need the rubber wedges. And you really have to have a test pattern generator to do this. So you get the rubber wedges in position, and then you use some convergence strips, which are sort of narrow strips with magnetic material at one end. And you can use those to kind of clean up the edges if there's a little bit of misconvergence that you can't get out by positioning the yoke correctly. So, and just to back up and say, what even is convergence? Convergence is making sure that if you have all three guns firing, that they are hitting the same spot on the face of the tube. And if you have a convergence error, you will see a shadow of red or blue typically around whites on the very edge of the display.
Yeah, it's like the crosshatch display. You'd see, you know, on the white one, you would see like a little hint of blue or red or
little bleed over the edge.
Yeah. That's usually that's the one I use, is the white crosshatch on the black background for this stuff.
That's good. That's a good one.
That's a good one. Nice hit.
Yep.
Yeah, it's got that, and it also, the Crafty Mech TPG has the little dot right in the center of the square, which lets you get it like really spot on if you can.
That's why I like my Wicco one, has the dots too. Dots and crosshatch. Way to open up a can of worms, Dave. Jesus.
Yeah, Dave's a good guy. I met him at Grinker.
Degauss your monitor, Dave.
Good fun. We'll see you next year. I'll bring at least another reject, maybe more.
And some water.
All right. What do we get? A voicemail next?
You get email.
We actually have an email.
That's right. We did voicemails.
Should we read the email or should we just give the?
You want to, well, it's
the summary.
Sum it up here. We got an email from a local person.
So we got an email from Rachel P, who is a local video game enthusiast, and she wrote about how her and her fiance have been attending the PRGE event for, I think it looks like she said this year will be her fourth year, and they've always liked the arcade games, but they're a little bit younger, so they weren't really in the arcades when it was all going down. She says that her first experience was in Arizona in a establishment called Golfland Sunsplash. And the first games that she remembered playing were Vampire Savior, which I've never played.
I think it's a CPS2 game.
Okay. Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, Gauntlet, Dance Dance Revolution. But they both have a special place in their heart for the classics. So she was talking about how she enjoys hearing us talk about the nostalgia of the games and what we remember about the games, and she appreciates that. And then she was asking us some questions about owning arcade games. One of the things that she was curious about was, do you power them off when they are not in use? Is your arcade on all the time, Jordan?
Ah, I got to go home and turn it off right now. No, that's always a super common question. People assume that you have your games on all the time and that your power bill must be insane. But no, I turn them on for people and that's about it. And if I want to play a game, I turn on that game and play it. Like, I think Ian turned on a handful of games for us tonight, and that's, you know, kind of the thing, together.
Then I heard my circuit breaker buzzing, and I turned one off.
And it's always hard to just describe, which I think is a good description of how much power it takes, is if you plug in a television or multiple televisions in a room, then, I mean, that's kind of the power it's gonna pull. It's not going to pull an astronomical amount of power and we only have our games on like maybe a few hours a week, so it's not anything that's going to really add to your electric bill.
Yep. Typically a video game will draw 1 to 1.5 amps of power, and a pinball machine is like 2 to 3 amps of power, so your usual home circuit is 15 amps, so that means you can put about 10 to 12 video games on one circuit safely with a little margin of error, and less pinball machines. Yeah. So
I think I have like four or five circuits run in my basement. Yeah.
I have not enough to power all my games in the same room, which is real sad.
I learned today that a kilowatt hour usually costs an average person 10 cents. So like a 1500 watt heater is 60 cents an hour to run, which would be I think it was like $18 a month. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really even cost more than like, you know, to have a TV running.
Yeah.
So it's like,
so her other question, or her third question, the first question that we didn't go over was she wanted to visit Jordan's Barthcade.
I actually emailed her back and invited her and her husband to come. We had the first annual Coin Rejects listener appreciation party at the at the Barthcade.
Complete with stickers.
Yep, complete with swag to hand out, and they did not show up. So.
Why are we even reading this email?
Come on, Rachel.
What's the deal?
Come out of the woodwork.
Fucks.
Maybe next time. So anyhow, that's one of the things I love to do is share my games with others. And I've had plenty of people in my basement that I barely knew, or friends of people that I didn't know at all. And it's always fun to meet new people, and I'm not scared. So come on back.
You're at the age now.
I don't care.
Yeah, go fuck.
So she also asked, is maintaining these machines a full-time job? Do you find certain ones break more often, or does it just depend on the condition of the game when you buy it?
Jeez, it could be.
Yeah.
It could be a full-time
pole
job.
Pole position?
I just fixed pole position, like last night. Yeah.
You know, the pro tip is just don't play it.
Yeah, for like, if you never turn them on, then you never know they're broken, and you don't have to repair them as much.
Just turn the marquee lights on.
Yeah. I sort of have the opposite theory, which is that not play, like if I play the games regularly, I find they break less.
I agree. I totally agree with that, because when I moved all my games to the garage, all of them broke. And, no, I'm serious.
Well, yeah, because you lost the key.
Don't move them to the garage.
And, then you deal with temperature issues and, that's a huge thing, is like power cycling games with like the cold hot actually is bad.
But certainly, some games tend to break more than others.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, definitely games
like Galaga, pole position.
If you want something reliable, then you'd go with the evil choice of just getting that crappy 16-1 and then just buying another $30 one when it breaks.
Those aren't that reliable, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, 30 bucks.
There's plenty of games that don't break. You know, you just don't know which ones they are. Yeah. Until
just
you
buy nothing from Sega or...
that dovetails into her last question, was do certain manufacturers or machines tend to break more often than others?
Segas are fucking terrible.
Yeah. Yep.
Anything with, like
pinball.
Capcom, Suicide boards, the era of games where they got into copy protection and all that.
Hard drives, spinning disc hard drive
the more
games.
Technology progressed in games, the more I don't know, I would say kind of unreliable.
What about laser discs?
Yeah. Not only, those are always broke.
I mean, they may be more reliable in some aspects, but then also that when they do break, they're impossible to fix.
I would say, just stick with games that are not too rare to where you can get parts for them if they break. You know, like your Pac-Man, it doesn't matter. You can get another Pac-Man board for $100, you know. So you don't have to learn to repair it.
That's why...
You know, on a deep level, I suppose. You just... Video games are a power supply, a game PCB, a monitor, and that's about it. A control. Controls don't break. I mean, unless they're all fucked up when you buy them, and then you refurb them, and that's that. I don't know.
Don't buy anything rare. I mean, basically, if you buy, like, a common classic Pac-Man Galaga, then there'll be so many spare parts available that...
Well...
There's some...
Galaga
There are some exceptions to that rule, I would say. Pole position is definitely, high production classic game, and the boards are expensive as balls because they're extremely flaky. Galaga, not quite as flaky, but similar boat.
Omega Race.
Yeah, anything with a battery on it.
Q-Bert.
Yep.
Yep. These are all games that I would say they're great games, but probably avoid if you don't want to work on games.
Basically, ask questions and get involved with the locals and the forums, and then buy versus buy and then ask questions why, your piece of shit Sega Vector game doesn't work.
Wizard of War, Sega G80, GORF,
anything that needs more than two boards.
Yeah, all the card rack games.
Ribbons.
Yeah, ribbon. Yeah, MCR games, so your Tron.
Or anything with a CPU.
Tapper.
Tapper, Timber, Distatron. They're great games, but you're probably going to run into an issue at some point.
Yeah, I would say the games I have that have been the hardest to keep up are Galaga, Missile Command, Crazy Climber. Crazy Climber has been a little flaky and is just tough to repair because they have a bunch of copy protection shit.
Oh, Richard's got this. His TOEI monitor is now fucked up in this Crazy Climber. You worked on one of those yet?
Nope.
GO7 swap done.
Yeah, I got the Tato. I put a nice burn-free tube swap in there.
It's a 100-volt TOEI. So,
love that.
Yeah. Omega Race. Games with batteries, like the
Nintendo
batteries on the board.
Games? I only have one, so...
Oh, yeah. Their power supplies are a pain to fix, and, power supplies are a fairly common failure on any game, so that's a hassle, and...
Vector games, man.
The earlier Nintendo board stacks where they have like 8 different boards and 1,000 ribbon connectors. And that stuff's a hassle.
That's an exaggeration. Eight board stack.
They have 4 PCBs and about 8 different connections just to the PCB from the cabinet instead of one.
And that's not including all the others.
And they have at least a half dozen connections in between all the boards. Real pain in the butt.
My Donkey Kong is all those little connectors.
Yeah.
Is that standard for a Nintendo?
So they moved away from it. it and to a regular 22-pin edge connector, but all the early Nintendo stuff uses those ribbon connectors.
Black and white vectors, man. I think those are some of the most reliable.
I think they're pretty simple, too. Yeah, and those vector monitors, the black and white ones, are pretty stout.
Yep, I can agree with that. Yeah.
So get yourself an Asteroids.
Yep, they made a lot.
They're Asteroids cheap. Deluxe.
Oh, there you go. Better game. All right. Nobody else loves us?
Nope.
Well, we can move on from that.
That is the end of our listener feedback. Thank you, everybody, for writing us, calling us, and we encourage you to write, call, tweet, Instagram, carrier pigeon, whatever, float your boat.
And if we missed you, we're sorry. Yeah. There is other feedback, but we probably just missed it.
Just call back. It's fine.
You got some names on this list,
though. Oh, yeah. We do know. We do. Yeah. We can do a couple shout-outs here. We already talked about Dave from Buffalo. We know Chuck listens to the show. We had him on last episode. Stimpy up in Washington.
Stetson.
Yeah, I like playing his games. And Chris Mansfield up in Washington. Mano Man. Andrew B. Rob McGrath. And Michael Zenner. Zen Master. That's right. And WebDoc. So we know all those guys listen to us. So there you go. There's our shout-out.
Hey, WebDoc, my internet isn't working. Can you please? it hurts when I do this.
It hurts when I right-click.
Yeah. So I don't know. That's a pretty good show. We're at, an hour and 20 minutes here.
Do we want to do any updates on our
show?
No.
Okay. I think you should.
No, too long already.
Too long.
All right. That's what she said.
Too long, too hard.
Too thick.
All right, so that wraps up another show for us. Be sure to visit our website where there are photos of each episode in case you are curious on what we all look like.
It's just a picture of a phone with the podcast. That's it. Photo of the episode.
CoinRejects.com, Twitter.com/CoinRejects, Instagram.com/CoinRejects, and the voicemail number is
503-766-2263.
All right, let's play some games.
Nice.
Yeah.